This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Harvard Law School professor and best-selling author Lawrence Lessig made a bid for the presidency last year. He entered the Democratic primary race but soon abandoned his effort. He's seen firsthand the nature of American politics and believes the system is corrupt. Lawrence Lessig will be at the University of Dayton tomorrow evening to talk on the importance of the first presidential debate, just 5 days before Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump take the stage for their first debate. I recently talked with Professor Lessig to get his thoughts on the current political system and his suggestions to improve the process. Lawrence, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
What led you to run for the Democratic nomination in the first place?
Well, I was trying to become a candidate so that I would have the opportunity in the debates to focus the Democratic Party on a fact which I think most Americans recognize, which is until we fix this corrupted democracy, we're not going to get any of the changes that we as Democrats or as Republicans would want. And unless the politicians commit to fixing this corrupted democracy, we won't see that change happen. And so I wanted a chance as a candidate to make that central and to hear Hillary and Bernie at least both say, yes, that's right. The first thing we do must be to fix this corrupted democracy.
So when you talk about a corrupted democracy, you're talking about the influence of money in politics?
Mainly, but not just. I mean, that's the most grotesque way in which we have an unequal democracy, but also the way politicians gerrymander the House of Representatives so that, you know, the politicians pick the voters rather than the voters picking the politicians. And what that does is it means that something close to 90 million Americans don't have any effective representation in the House of Representatives because they've been gerrymandered out of any relevance to the member who happens to represent them. So these are just, you know, one of many ways the politicians have worked to make the system not responsive to the people, but instead responsive to the people who fund their campaigns or the people who control their party. And what I think is, as many Americans think, we've got to find a way to change that system if we're ever going to get a democracy that's responsive to us.
Now, you have a home in Iceland, which just held its presidential election in June. And correct me if I'm wrong, Lawrence, there were 10 people on the ballot, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right. And a history professor was actually elected as president of Iceland.
Do you think that there's anything the U.S. could learn from Iceland about coming up with a field of candidates?
Well, I think actually the interesting lesson from Iceland is the process which they've gone through here to draft a new constitution. You know, after the crisis, many people said that it was time to deal with the, you know, corruption in Iceland's government. So they started crowdsourcing a constitution. Then they did that by having 1,000 people get together, a random selection of 1,000 people from Iceland to identify what the constitution should do, and then they drafted it, and then two-thirds of the people ratified it. And it's a really beautiful constitution that would really fundamentally change the way certain things work in Iceland that came really from the bottom up. And I think that is the example of how democracy could work, that we need to see more around the world, and especially in the United States, if we're going to deal with the extraordinary frustration, you know, legitimate frustration that people on the right and the left feel with the way their government doesn't work right now.
You think it's a little easier in Iceland's case because it's a smaller country? In the United States, you're talking about a much vaster country with a lot of different competing interests.
It is easier in one sense. But I think it's in Iceland, but I think it's easier in the United States in another sense, and that is that there's such agreement across the left and the right that our government has failed. And, you know, at a certain point, I think we can get people to put aside their political differences, which are significant. I don't think, you know, we all agree about a whole wide range of issues, but I do think we agree that our government has failed us. And I think we can actually get to a place where we can put those things aside long enough to fix the fundamental flaws and to get us a representative democracy, because that's the essential way in which we can make you know, government responsive either to the left when the left wins or the right when the right wins.
So what led you to drop your bid to become a candidate for the Democratic nomination?
Well, you know, the Democratic Party had set up a system for deciding who got in the debates, the set of rules. The end of October, my campaign manager called me and said, we've satisfied the rules. We had to get three polls finding it more than at 1% support. And then 4 days later, we got a call from the Democratic Party telling us that we didn't understand the rules, which meant they were changing the rules. So when they changed the rules to make it so I couldn't be in the debate, there was no reason for me to continue to, you know, ask my supporters to pull together the resources necessary to keep the campaign going. So I had to step out. But, you know, stepping out from running as a candidate for the president is different from stepping out from the fight. I'm as committed as I've ever been to finding a way to build the movement necessary to get us a democracy again.
So you're gonna keep up the fight, but would you ever consider running again? Trying again?
I'd do whatever it takes. Whatever it takes. Whatever makes sense. You know, the gamble was costly. It was costly to me personally, reputationally, financially. It was a very costly decision. But it was the right gamble because, we should have been in the debate. We qualified. We had the poll numbers necessary to be there. And had I been there, I do think that we could have at least changed the way the discussion developed, and you know, maybe bridge some of the gap that seemed to exist between Hillary and Bernie, and to get a commitment across the Democratic Party, which I think could actually, you know, if there were that commitment in the Democratic Party to fix this corrupted democracy, they would inspire a whole bunch of people to vote for them beyond just their fear of, the presidential candidate on the Republican side.
Do you think it's become difficult, the way our political system is structured, to get a large number? Like in Iceland's case, they got 10 people who are running for president. Do you think the way the system is structured in the United States, it's difficult to find and get good people, qualified people to run for offices?
Well, I think that it's difficult to get an interesting diversity. You know, if you put aside the presidency, which of course is insane for all sorts of reasons, and just think about Congress, you know, the most important job of a member of Congress today is to raise money to run for Congress. Now, they spend 30% to 70% of their time raising money to get back into power, to get their party back into power. And when they do that, they, of course, learn to bend themselves to the interest of those who are going to fund their campaigns. And the people who are funding their campaigns are not average Americans. They're the richest slice of America. And I don't think this is actually, you know, some people think it's a kind of class war. I don't think it's a class war. It's just there are special interests who are willing to spend whatever it takes to buy government. And they do that. And government bends to their interests because they need their money to run their campaigns. And so when you think about, do we have the right kind of diversity of people running? There is literally one blue-collar member of Congress. One member of Congress who's a blue-collar, who is blue-collar. And when you think about that and recognize that the people who get elected to Congress are the people with the biggest Rolodex who can raise money to get to Congress, so typically white male lawyers, they are the most prominent member of Congress, you begin to understand why we don't have a government that's responsive to average Americans, and we won't have that government until we elect people in some way other than asking who can raise the most money in the shortest time.
Who do you think you talk about one blue-collar member of Congress? Who do you think that is? Who qualifies in your...
Mike. He's actually representing Cambridge, Mike Capuano, who's classically blue-collar. People are going to argue with me. They're going to say there are four or five. But look, there ought to be, 70 or 80 or 90 at least. There ought to be, more women in Congress. And they can't be more women in Congress because, women don't have the Rolodex to raise the money necessary to get to Congress. There ought to be a representative Congress that ought to represent America, all of America. Instead, we have a Congress that's representing, an intellectual elite, lawyers, representing a tiny slice of people who learn very quickly how to bend in the direction of those who are funding their campaign.
What's happened to the concept of the citizen lawmaker, somebody who would go serve their time and when they finished, they were done, went back to their private life?
Yeah, there's no such thing anymore. And I think the bigger problem to that, I favor the idea of term limits at some point, although not very short. But what I favor more is the idea of representatives who are really trying to represent the people in their district. That's really hard today. because most representatives realized that if all they did was represent the people in their district, they couldn't afford to run for Congress. So they got to represent the people in the district plus the funders of campaigns. You know, the trick is, the trick that, you know, corrupts American politics is they have to make the funders happy first, and then they get to run and get the votes of the people. Well, you know, there was a guy named Boss Tweed who used to run the Tammany Hall political machine in New York in the 19th century. Boss Tweed used to say, "I don't care who does the electing, as long as I get to do the nominating." And that is the kind of genius in that corruption, right? Because people can think that they're actually doing the electing because they're the ones that do the voting. But if the people they're electing have already been pre-selected by the people who fund campaigns, then we don't get a chance to vote for the people we otherwise would be voting for. And we don't have a democracy that's responsive to the average American. So this is a point that people on the right and the left increasingly recognize. You know, one of the reasons early on in the campaign there was so much support for Donald Trump was that at that stage of the campaign, at least, he was calling out the role of money in the Republican Party. He said, "Every one of you guys is bought. I paid for most of you," when he was on that first Republican debate. And it was a shocking thing to say. When he said it, most Americans heard it and said, "That's right. This system is corrupted by money. And it's corrupted in the Democratic Party, and it's corrupted in the Republican Party." And many of the people supporting Bernie Sanders, that was exactly why they supported Bernie Sanders. They said, you're not somebody who's bought off by money, and he refused to take big money or have super PACs, and he raised an incredible amount of money in small contributions. That taste for reforming the system is a fundamental part of the political psyche right now. And it's one of the weak reasons, frankly, Hillary Clinton's not doing as well as she should. New York Times did a poll that was released today and found only 36% of Americans thought she would be an agent of change, and a much higher percentage thought Donald Trump would be an agent of change. And this explains part of the reason why people are so supportive of Donald Trump when, you know, many Democrats look at this and say, "How is this even possible?" The reason is, people are so angry, so frustrated with a corrupted political system, and they want to see it changed.
The Citizens United decision, Lawrence, some people say that, well, this protects free speech. That's what the majority of the justices, how they viewed it. Others say that this just furthers the corrupting influence of money on the political process. What is your view on that particular decision?
Well, I thought it was an unfortunate decision. Even worse was a decision that came afterwards in a lower court called Speech Now, and it's that decision that actually created the super PAC. And I think the super PAC is a really corrupting part of the political process right now, especially increasingly in the context of Congress. But, you know, it's too simple to pretend that the Supreme Court has broken our democracy, as if before Citizens United, January 20th, 2010, somehow we had a perfectly well-functioning democracy and the Supreme Court shot it. The Supreme Court may have shot the body, but the body was already cold. And it was already cold because for the last 50 years, we have allowed the influence of money to become ever more significant in our politics long before super PACs. And the only way we will ever fix that is to begin to talk about something that politicians are terrified to talk about, which is citizen funding of campaigns. No longer having it so that, you know, the special interests fund the campaigns, but have it so all of us are funding campaigns. So I support an idea that many Republicans are pushing now called vouchers, where you give everybody a rebate on their taxes to as a democracy voucher, and I can use that voucher to, you know, contribute to candidates that I support. And if every voter had a voucher, then candidates would raise their money in a radically different way. They wouldn't be raising their money from the oil interest, or wouldn't be raising their money from the George Soroses or the super PACs. They would be raising their money from average Americans, and that would make them more democratic. And so I think we have to accept the Supreme Court made a mistake, but even if the Supreme Court had gotten that decision right, we still would have a corrupted democracy, and we will only have a reform of that democracy if we change the way we fund campaigns.
Now, let's talk about the upcoming debates. There have been a lot of analysts saying that this first debate, because the race is so tight between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton right now in the polls, a lot of analysts are saying that this first debate is going to be a difference maker, that it's so crucial. Do you have that same view? How critical do you think this first debate is going to be?
It is going to be absolutely, absolutely critical. And it's incredibly dangerous for the Democrats because the truth is Donald Trump goes into this debate with such low expectations, and he will easily outdo those low expectations. And when he outdoes the low expectations, then you're going to have all the press talking about how, oh my gosh, he seemed more presidential than we thought he was. And all of a sudden, the frame around his campaign that somehow he's not presidential enough will collapse. And I think that will put enormous pressure on Hillary Clinton. Now, I think if they're smart, they're thinking this, and they're thinking, what can we do in this debate to make the story about what we said? And I think what she should do is she needs to become, you know, like Nixon going to China or Lyndon Johnson supporting civil rights. Do something no one expects, and that is commit herself absolutely to fixing this corrupted democracy. And if she said, look, give me a Democratic Congress, and I guarantee in the first 100 days we will end the corrupting influence of money in politics, we will end the stupid system of gerrymandering, we will make it so everybody has an equal opportunity to vote, that would be enormously exciting to people to imagine that we could actually have a chance of doing that. And though not everybody would believe her, because she has a long history that has led many people to believe she doesn't really care about reform. The point is it would split the most strong negative view that people have about her and make it hopeful for her that that she could rally people to the idea of a promising outcome to this election as opposed to the fear that I think most people have about this election right now. So I think this is going to be a critically important debate, and what they need to do is to stop thinking, how do we run the time out? How do we run the clock out on this election? And start thinking about, how do we get the ball and move it down to the goal line so that we can win, as opposed to making it so Donald Trump loses.
Do you agree with the debate formats that we use, having a moderator or a panel moderators?
Well, I think the idea of moderators is fine. I think we've made a big mistake in turning moderation over to entertainment figures. I think it would be much better to imagine, you know, people who are good at getting people to answer the question being moderators. People who are good at, like, knowing the facts and saying, wait a minute, you're saying this today, but on June 5th you said something different. And who are committed like a prosecutor almost. Like, let's have a Democratic prosecutor and a Republican prosecutor and have those two prosecutors as the moderators and have them ask the questions and have them be able to follow up in a really aggressive way without fearing that their network will be punished or that their future as a interviewer will be hampered by being too aggressive against one party or the other. Because I think one of the big weaknesses we have in America right now is we don't have a strong and independent press. We have a press that is so terrified to anger really either side that they facilitate the kind of dissembling that goes on both sides. So I think moderators are fine, but what we need is really professional moderators, people who are really good.
And bipartisan moderators, it sounds like, too. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
It doesn't look like Gary Johnson's going to be included in the debates. Do you think he and Jill Stein should be allowed on the podium?
I think that the debate commission's 15% rule was wildly too high, and that was designed to make sure nobody else was on stage. But I think the reality is neither of them has demonstrated, even a substantial, even above 10% support right now. And I fear that, given the way the Electoral College works, you know, it could be, we don't want to replicate what happened in 2000. And, you know, because that was so devastating already. And so I'm not really eager to see a situation where we don't get a majority commitment for support. I'm somebody who supports the idea, actually Maine is going to vote on it this year, of allowing what's called ranked choice voting for, you know, candidates. So what you'll be able to say is, he's my first choice, here's my second choice, here's my third choice. And then the computer automatically, you know, tallies, and if your first choice doesn't win, then your vote gets counted for your second choice. So your second choice doesn't win, then it gets counted for your third choice. But the reason that's so important is that it would allow people to begin to say, look, I really believe in Gary Johnson's message more than I do in Hillary Clinton's, or more than I do in Donald Trump. I'm going to vote for Gary Johnson, but I'm not going to make it so that my worst choice becomes president, because, okay, if Gary Johnson doesn't win, then my second vote is for Hillary, or my second vote's for Donald Trump. That system would allow and, I think, encourage outsiders to be more competitive. But I think right now, I think people fear that, you know, what will happen is what happened in 2000, where, you know, if you look to the close to 100,000 people who voted for Ralph Nader in Florida and ask if those people had to vote for George Bush or Al Gore, would 500 more vote for Gore than for Bush? Because that was the difference between Gore and Bush in Florida. I think most people realize that that was lost by that incredible number of people who didn't vote for one of the first two.
Back to the debates, if Donald Trump falls into the same debate style that he used during the primary, you think that that could totally throw off Hillary Clinton, throw her off her game, and boost his numbers?
Yeah, I do, because you know, it's another thing to remember from 2000, the debate between Al Gore and George Bush. Al Gore was so dismissive and so impatient, and really in people read it. I mean, I know Gore a little bit, and I don't think this is fair to say of him, but they read it as him being condescending, that it really hurt him dramatically. And I could easily imagine, you know, Hillary becoming so impatient and so dismissive and so angry at Donald Trump being Donald Trump that it doesn't actually help her. It actually hurts her. And so I'm sure that what they're doing in preparing her is to say to her, look, you need to appear the presidential one on that stage. Because, you know, as much as the policy wonks like to think that people will decide who to vote for based on which person really supports more policies that that person cares about, the truth is people are going to vote based on who they think they trust and who they want to give their faith to in the next election. And that's going to be driven a large part by, you know, the character of these two people. And if she has anything going into this, and, you know, God knows I've been critical of all sorts of policy positions that she's had, but if she has any real advantage going into this, it's that people, when they see the two of them together, will say Hillary Clinton's behaving presidentially, and Donald Trump is not. I know that's not universal, and I know many people will still see Donald Trump as a powerful outsider who has a stronger chance of changing Washington than Hillary Clinton. But I think that she will not win by outdoing Donald Trump with Trumpisms. I think she will win by seeming more presidential than he does.
Lawrence, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Harvard Law School professor and former presidential candidate Lawrence Lessig. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7 in the Kennedy Union Ballroom on the University of Dayton campus. A book signing will immediately follow. Professor Lessig is the second guest in the UD Speaker Series. And you can find a link to more information at wvxu.org. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at wvxu.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. The number of social enterprises in Greater Cincinnati continues to grow as more people realize the value of using a combination of for-profit and non-profit models to improve society. On the next Cincinnati Edition, we'll hear about the upcoming Social Enterprise Cincy Summit and learn more about self-sustaining businesses that provide opportunities for the impoverished and chronically unemployed to create new lives for themselves. That's on Cincinnati Edition, tomorrow afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.